Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. As often I do now, I want to remind you that we have a volunteer, Charlie, who is willing and able to take your suggestions for topics we might cover, documents we might look at, and so on, become in a way a partner of this program. To do that, send whatever it is you have to suggest to the following, charlie.info438@gmail.com. That's charlie.info438@gmail.com. In today's program, we're going to be talking about a federal program of rent control. We're going to be talking about the United States-China tension and how America's allies are beginning to think again about being allies of the United States, given the struggle with China. And finally, we're going to talk about the drug shortage that is plaguing the American healthcare scene and take a look at why. In the second half of the program today, we'll be talking about inequality in the United States, how it grew, why it grew, and what are its important implications, which I think will shed some interesting light on the politics tearing this country apart right now. So let's jump right in. Recently, 30 well-known economists signed a letter published in many places around the United States demanding federal rent control. The cost of renting an apartment has shot up. It's a major cause of the inflation we have been suffering over the last 2 or 3 years. Rents are out of control. One of the signs of it is growing homelessness because people can't afford the rising rents. And there doesn't seem to be much anyone is doing about it except lamenting the fact. I wanted to get at this notion of rent control because in the letter, the economists tell us how it can be done. Here's their suggestion. There are two government agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that are very active in the government support of the housing of the United States. As I'll explain in a moment, there would not be the mass housing of individuals in this country, in apartments or in their own homes, without government subsidy and government support. It's one of the examples that you have to give to people who say, this is an economy based on individual private enterprise. No, it isn't. No, it never was. It is an economic system dependent on the government and nowhere more so than in housing. Let me explain. In 1938, the depths of the U.S. Depression, the government set up Fannie Mae. And here's what that agency of the government does. It goes to banks around the country and it says, if you lend money to someone to buy a home, to someone to build a multi-home apartment complex, here's what you can do. You lend them the money. They sign an agreement called a mortgage. And here's what we'll let you do, Mr. Banker. We'll let you turn around and sell that mortgage to us, a government agency. We'll allow banks across the country to do that, which they never could do before. And we will take the risk away from them because they can sell us the mortgage literally the next day after they have arranged it with a borrowing family. And we will bundle them together and create a new kind of security that can be invested in by people around the world, giving them a piece of a bundle of mortgages as they are paid back each month. Before Fannie Mae, before this was done, it was typical in this country that if you wanted to buy a home, you had to put down 50% as a down payment, and there were lots of restrictions on how easily the bank could take the home away from you. A private housing system, which is what existed, was unaffordable by the mass of Americans. So the government stepped in, made it affordable by this arrangement, which ended up allowing you to get a home with a much lower down payment and with much less burdensome conditions. And what these economists are saying is, let's face it, the government supports housing in this country. It subsidizes it by removing the risks from the bank lenders, etc. Let's get something in return for the average person. Rent control would be something that could be administered both by Fannie Mae and the additional agency, Freddie Mac, that was set up in 1970. It shows it can be done. If the political will is there, we could have the rent control around the country that already exists in cities like New York and many other places where it has been quite successful for decades. The second update today starts with the HSBC Bank. That is the largest bank in Europe, so it's the equivalent of JP Morgan Chase here in the United States. And I want you to listen as I read a statement made by the executive, a major executive at that bank, and a former diplomat for the United Kingdom in England. His name is Sherard Cowper-Coles, and he made these comments at a meeting of financiers in London a couple of months ago. Here we go. Quote, "I think the politicians in my own country, in America and elsewhere, who demonize China, who see the world as black and white, it is they who are naive." What does he mean? He means to say, and this is echoed by more and more politicians and businessmen and women across Europe, that they are being terribly badly hurt by the U.S. confrontation with China. China is allied to Russia. China is supporting Russia in the Ukraine. That means that the energy, the cheap energy that, for example, fueled the ability of Europe to compete in the world by buying cheap oil and gas from Russia, is no longer available to Europe. Energy prices are out of control there. There's a recession in Germany, the strongest economy in Europe. And what Mr. Cowper-Coles, a leading diplomat and business person in England, who has no sympathy or alliance with Russia, China, or anyone else, is that it is destructive of Europe's economy to be lined up with the United States in this confrontation. It's hurting them more than it's hurting the United States, and they don't like it. Let me read you next a quotation from a former Samsung executive, Yang Hyang-ja by name, now a member of the parliament in South Korea. He warns the United States to, quote, "stop punishing businesses for doing business with China. It may drive Asian countries to ally against the United States if it keeps up this America First campaign." Why am I bringing this to you? Because we are watching the disintegration of the unity of the United States and the capitalist West, which includes Japan. They are not experiencing the U.S. struggle with China the way the U.S. is. It's costing them more, and they will not continue to tolerate. That's not only why these business leaders are saying it. It's important to understand that's why it's getting more and more publicity, so people around the world, like me, for example, encounter it in financial documents, in financial news reporting. The Europeans are beginning to ask themselves this question. As the world economy shapes into a struggle between China and its allies on the one hand, and the United States and its allies on the other, have the Europeans confronting this split, have they bet on the wrong horse by siding with the United States? This is an extremely crucial question, and how it will be answered will tell us a lot about what's going to happen in the world economy from now on. I want to turn next to the matter of the drug shortage here in the United States. In case you have not heard, let me tell you a little bit about it. One of the most important drugs we have in this country, antibiotics, are in short supply. Around the United States, people are going to drugstores to pick up antibiotics and being informed that they're not available. The disease known as ADHD is in short supply in terms of its medication. 14 essential cancer drugs are likewise under shortages. What's going on? First of all, it's important to understand that the medications in these cases are called generics. What that means is that the patent on a new medicine, which allows only the manufacturer to produce it for a certain number of years, have run out on these medicines. So anybody and everybody can produce them. There's no longer patent protection. They're called generic drugs for that reason. 90% of prescriptions in the world are written for generic drugs. Here's the problem. If everybody can make them, the competition among producers drives down the price of these drugs, so they're more readily available to people, which you might think is a good thing, and it is for the people who need the drugs. But it's not a good thing for the drug companies that want profit by producing them. So here's what they do, because this is how capitalism works. They cut the production. They make shortages. They make people desperate. They make stories appear in the press, like the one I'm giving you now, telling you about it. And why? Because they're going to use the shortage as an excuse to jack up the price. That will then justify them to make more of them because the profit will have been raised. But here's the problem, and it's a very typical problem for capitalism. Other capitalists don't want to pay higher prices for drugs. They don't want that solution. If the mass of people have to pay more for drugs, that's going to put pressure to raise wages to enable people to pay for the higher cost of drugs. Many corporations have drug deals for their employees, and they don't want to pay higher premiums to cover the higher prices of the medication. So what you got here is a classic split between the profiteers in the drug-making business and the profiteers everywhere else. The drug-making profiteers want to jack up prices to do the same with their profits. And the rest of the capitalists don't want it because it'll hurt their profits. And we are the spectators. Who are we? The people, the mass of the people, going to wait and see who wins in this struggle. And in the middle, a group of well-intentioned people, friends of mine included, are working hard for a public pharma industry. The government should take over the production of drugs because the government doesn't have to make a profit when it produces the drugs. The government can make sure the drugs are available, whether they're profitable or not. There are states in the United States that are already doing it. California is producing insulin for people who are on diabetes to deal with the shortages and the prices there. I understand the impulse. I support it. But I would like it to be understood that we ought to be asking the question, why in the world do we make medications that people's health and life depend on a matter of fights among competing profiteers? That's not the way to take care of that kind of problem. We've come to the end of the first half. Please stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about inequality in the United States and its enormous importance and impact. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. As promised at the beginning of the show, we're now going to talk about inequality in the United States. I'm particularly concerned to make it clear where the inequality comes from, and then I'm equally concerned to talk a little bit about its implications, particularly for the political crisis deepening in the United States as I speak with you. So first, let's talk about rising inequality. And here I'm looking at the basically the last half century of the United States, from the 1960s to right now, 2023. Let's begin with four signs, symptoms, measurements, if you like, of inequality. In the 1960s, the average CEO, chief executive officer of an American corporation, the average, earned about 20 times what the median employee of that CEO's firm earned. CEO to middle-level employee, 20 times. What is it today? Get ready. 300 times. A change over half a century from CEOs earning 20 times to CEOs earning 300 times. These are averages. This is a change in the distribution of income and wealth that is cataclysmic. The implications of this are spectacular. CEOs of major corporations are the equivalent of pharaohs in ancient Egypt. Their enormous wealth is out of any parallel in American history, or for that matter, in the history of most other countries. The average CEO to worker ratio in Europe is much lower than what it is in the United States. It's much lower in Japan. It's remarkable. Here's the second one. The top bracket of the personal income tax, that is the highest bracket that the richest people have to pay. In the 1960s, it was 70%. So the richest Americans had to pay at the top, on the biggest chunk of their wealth, 70% of their income each year. Out of every dollar above in that bracket, they had to give Uncle Sam 70 cents. What is the highest bracket rich people have to give to the federal government today? 39%. Please understand, from the 60s to now, the richest people's income tax dropped from 70 to 39%. All right. What share of the government's revenue, federal government, Washington, came from taxes on corporate profits? In the 1960s, that rate was twice what it is today. Today, the federal government's revenue from taxing corporations is 6% of the total revenue the government gets. The rest of it is basically paid by individuals. Wow. What a shift. From taxing corporations to individuals, and from taxing the richest individuals to, you guessed it, you and me. And that's why we have enormous inequality. But one more reason. What happened to wages between the 1960s and today? The answer is they went nowhere. It's really important to understand that if you adjust the wages Americans got for the prices they have to pay to get what economists call the real wage, what you can afford to buy with the wages you get, the real wage in this country has stagnated for 50 years. It has gone nowhere. When you adjust for prices, the average wage in the United States today is very little different from what it was, say, in 1978. That means that the economic growth of the United States, the productivity that went up with the arrival of atomic energy, with the arrival of the computer, the robot, artificial intelligence, all the gains in output made possible over the last 50 years did not go to the working class. They went to the ruling class. That's why we have the inequality that we see all around us. Okay, what are the results of economic inequality, especially when it goes this fast. It would be different if it went very slowly over centuries, but this is very fast. Here's what it produces, and we have examples other times in history, so we know that this is not surprising, the list I'm about to give you. Resentments rise. Who? Where? Among people who are not participating in the good news about rising wealth of the folks at the top. They're the ones who see other people with wealth, but don't participate in it themselves. Tension between the haves and the have-nots. Conflict between the haves and the have-nots. Rich people becoming very fearful that their wealth becoming so extreme and so unusual will excite the envy, the bitterness, and the opposition of all of those who are not participating in the wealth creation. And that gives opportunity to political scapegoating. What do I mean? If you make the mass of people relatively poorer in relationship to the small minority that are cashing in, the CEOs and other top officials who've really raked it in over the last 50 years, you're going to see people ask the following question. I'm not getting this wealth. Why not? Who is? Why am I suffering? Why am I among the people who keep saying there's too much month at the end of the money? And they look around with the help of demagogic politicians who finger for them the people who are getting the help, are getting a piece of the action that you're not getting. And who are they? The Republican Party politicians in the lead, but there are Democrats who do the same. Here's a popular one. The government is taking care of all these immigrants, you see, and that's why you don't get. They're getting. It's not true. It's not supported by the facts. Nothing close to it makes any sense at all, but it does answer the question, I'm not getting because I see myself having more and more difficulty. And I'm angry at those who are apparently getting help because I'm not. And I want to prevent the immigrant from coming here, even if my own grandmother and grandfather were immigrants just like them. Here's another one. It's those non-white people who are getting this advantage and that opportunity. They're getting help. I'm not getting it. I'm becoming relatively poorer. I went to college, but my college-age children are unable to afford it without a mountain of debt that they can't afford either. I'm being sacrificed. But there are all these programs I hear about that help women instead of men. Non-white people instead of white. Whoa. And all you need is a politician to get up there and say, that's where the problem is. The horrible resurgence of white supremacy. The spectacle of Americans cheering on, putting immigrant children in cages. These are signs of a society falling apart as it tries to cope with the opposite of what was promised. Americans in the 20th century were told, if you work hard, if you behave properly, if you go to school, if you get a degree, you will have a good, secure job. That's not true anymore. And we have an entire population struggling to come to terms. Why is that? Is that my fault? Is it something else? Is it those immigrants? Is it? This country is tearing itself apart in large part over the consequences of a tremendous change in the distribution of income and wealth. The mass of people have not increased their real wealth for decades, while a tiny proportion at the top have accumulated wealth we haven't seen for millennia in the world for a tiny group of people. In any society, that would be difficult. But in a society like the United States, which for most of the 20th century congratulated itself for being a vast middle class or having the greatest standard of living, all of that is disappearing. The wealth is there, it's just concentrated in the hands of people who boast about having 26 homes, each one a mansion bigger than the other one, who dispose personally of hundreds of billions of dollars, while the mass of the people on this planet are worried about the next meal, keeping their home, getting an education for their children, getting adequate medical care. There is an explosion building. The capitalist system cannot survive producing inequality as fast and as enormous as this society is doing. And there has to be a recognition, or else this explosive potential will become an actual explosion. One of the consequences of the inability of the mass of people to deal with the fact that there's too much month at the end of the money is to solve that problem in the manner that the American working class has solved it, by borrowing more money than any working class in the history of the world ever did. That's not a sign of an opportunity. That's a sign of desperation. You borrow money when the wages you earn are not enough to purchase the things you need. And the American working class has suffered from a stagnant wage while it confronts endless advertising about what the American dream is all about. And if you're really a good American, you achieve that dream, and you should be working hard, and you should be earning enough. And if you're not, do you give up the dream? No. What Americans do is they borrow until they can't anymore. And what happens then? We're about to find out in a system that, in the terms of inequality, is now deserving of the phrase out of control. Thank you for your attention. I hope you have found this economic update to be valuable, informative, and interesting. And as always, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.